America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight, recently reissued as of December the 4th by St. Martin's Press. Harry, I was talking a little bit before the break about the obvious issue of the globalization of the economy. This North American Union comes to mind, and this gigantic Trans-Texas Corridor Highway is, of course, been a big topic of conversation just in the state of Texas, but it appears to be part of a wider movement toward a highway system that would eventually link Mexico, the United States, and Canada in some sort of a burgeoning free trade agreement. I suspect that will continue to impact when it comes to pass and to complete fruition. Will continue to impact these smaller communities in the rural South and the rural Midwest. As far as the people that remain in a town like Skidmore, trying to maintain the traditions, trying to maintain the oral legends and histories, trying to maintain some semblance of a connection to their generational family pasts, do you sense in talking with these folks now that they have a feeling of desperation about these changes in the sociology and culture of America? Are they quietly resigned to it? Is there a sense of tragedy about the whole thing? What's your take on that?
There's definitely a sense of sadness because the current farmers, the people owning and working the land now, are very connected to it, like their parents and their grandparents were. Their children are not. Maybe there's one son who's going to farm it when they die. But they sense the inevitability of it with inheritance taxes and all the problems that come with passing land down to another generation and the kind of inevitable, it seems to be inevitable, incorporation or, let's say, buying of the farm land by corporations. But the one thing that always, you're talking about what survives from that town, the one value that survives, even in the younger generation, is work. Those farmers love hard work. They are dedicated to hard work. It is the measure of a man or a woman how hard he works. If he gets up at 6, if he's on his tractor by 6, and he's still on his tractor when the sun goes down, you can forgive him a lot of other sins, a lot of other shortcomings. It's work, hard work, and I'm sure your dad experienced that too. It is the predominant value, and that is still there, surprisingly.
Yes, and as you look at some of this, I'm trying to picture this type of a community, knowing what I know about some of the smaller towns in southwestern Iowa and Fremont County, Iowa. I try to picture a community in the midst of what was going on in the aftermath of this July 10th, 1981 killing of McElroy. You allude to this or actually discuss it in Chapter 43 of Part 5 of your book, where you speak about the international media coverage that descended upon this town in the wake of this McElroy killing. The Kansas City Times, of course, picked up this story almost immediately. And the next thing you know, both wire services, all three of the then television networks were involved, the New York Times, the Minneapolis Tribune, the Miami Herald, the Chicago Tribune, the Omaha World Herald, the L.A. Times, Newsday, Der Spiegel in Germany, the London Daily News, the Stars and Stripes, Time, Newsweek, the BBC, Rolling Stone, Playboy, and Morley Safer's 60 Minutes. When that whole thing was going on in terms of that type of media circus and coverage in a town of this size, when we come back, I want to ask you what the take of the major media was at the time in regard to all of this, and what the townspeople may have shared with you in confidence about their perceptions of major media. We'll be back with Harry McLean for a longer piece of conversation to discuss In Broad Daylight, the new book or the reissue of a book by St. Martin's Press dealing with what happened in Skidmore, Missouri in July of 1981. Mark Dankos, America.
Hey, America, how does it feel to be flushed down the toilet of political intrigue and treachery into the sewer of slavery and bondage, where perverts and the godless write the rules? Our unborn children are murdered, our esteemed elders are euthanized, and everyone in between is numbered and tracked like criminals so they can be farmed by government, credit, healthcare organizations, like the chicken farmer farms his chickens. Have you had enough? Is it time to declare your liberty? It's your choice, you know. The only place to begin to declare your independence is to have enough food stored so that you never have to go stand in a bread line to give away the rest of your life or sell your children for a bowl of rice and a slice of bread. Call 800-409-5633. On the web, efoodsdirect.com. 800-409-5633.
Do you suffer from frequent and severe headaches? Well, you don't have to any longer. Headache Stay Gone is an all-natural headache remedy that is free of all side effects. Headache Stay Gone will cure any headache and prevent it from returning again. Painkillers can offer temporary relief at best, along with a long list of harmful side effects. Headache Stay Gone uses all-natural ingredients and cures your headache, letting you enjoy more time with your family and loved ones. We'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone today and send you the bill. Wait until your headache is cured before you pay for it. That's right, Headache Stay Gone must work for you before you pay for it. Try Headache Stay Gone risk-free by calling 1-800-327-0727 or visit www.headachestaygone.com. Again, that's 1-800-327-0727. And don't forget to ask about your risk-free trial today. Call now. Start living life without the headaches.
There is one and only one national populist news weekly, staffed by an unsurpassed team of veteran investigative journalists who have dared to rip the veil of deception from the cover-up stories promoted by the big money-controlled media monopoly.
American Free Press.
AFP's no-holds-barred journalists fearlessly seek the truth, no matter how controversial the issue. AFP publishes exciting, in-depth, uncensored news and information good patriotic Americans need to know to combat the coming police state being clamped in our republic. The American Free Press is your voice. Subscribe today and catch up on the real news. Mention RBN when you call and receive a one-year subscription, plus a copy of Michael Collins Piper's latest bestseller, The High Priests of War. All that for just $49? Call AFP toll-free, 888-699-NEWS, or visit AmericanFreePress.net.
We're back. This is Mark Dan Faust, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight, recently reissued as an updated, revised edition by St. Martin's Press. Harry, getting back into this whole business of what happened in Skidmore, Missouri, in July of 1981, and the aftermath of it in terms of the town and the international media coverage that followed. I was not up on the media coverage of this event at the time because I was ensconced at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Chicago and was spending the summer of 1981 and subsequently the summer of 1982 doing nothing but studying the Greek and Hebrew biblical languages on a crash basis. So I was a literal hermit, other than walking on the treadmill 15 minutes a day and eating my three meals. I wasn't doing anything other than cracking these books. So I don't remember the media spin at the time on this McElroy killing. Enlighten us, if you will, as to what the major international news media was saying at the time about the killing and about the town. And if you would, give us some insight as to what kind of feedback you were getting from the townspeople later in regard to their perceptions of corporate media.
Well, let me say first that this was pre-O.J. Simpson and pre-cable TV.
Yes.
So it's nothing compared to what it would be today. It almost looks like child's play in terms of what, if it happened today, the descent of the carnivores in the media world would be 50 times what it was back then. But back then, it seemed pretty big, and it was pretty big for this small town. The major thing, it was that they were in Kansas City covering the collapse of a bridge on the Hyatt Hotel. I don't know if you remember that, but it went over a street and it collapsed and killed a bunch of people in the bridge and fell on people and killed them too. So the New York Times and the L.A. Times were in Kansas City covering that story when news of McElroy's killing broke. And, of course, the first words that ever were said around the killing were town bully and vigilante act. And the town bully part of it was true. The vigilante act part of it was pretty much immediate creation. And by that I mean vigilante act means that the people in town agreed to kill McElroy beforehand, that it was a town that killed him. That's not true. Three people decided to kill him. Now, other people, you know, the rest of town kind of backed him up and protected him afterwards, but in terms of the act itself, the town was not guilty. But the story was vigilante, you know, the vigilante town, the town that killed the town bully. And that's the way the story ran. And they basically ignored a tremendous amount of facts. I mean, they went with a story that was going to sell, that was hot, and that was, you know, McElroy had done all this, and one day the town lost it and blew him away, and it's an old West story. It's 1881 rather than 1981, and it's an all-American story. And it was an easy story to tell, and it made for snappy, dramatic headlines. The problem with it was a lot of it was untrue, and a minimum amount of research could have shown that it was untrue. The people in town, some of them in the beginning, talked to the press. You'll always find somebody who will talk. And they said, yeah, McElroy did all this stuff, and this is what happened to him. Then they read the way they were portrayed, the way their statements were put into the press, and they saw how they were twisted. And they were twisted basically to show that the town had done the killing and supported the killers, which is not what these people were saying. But they saw the way they were portrayed in the newspapers, what was said about them, and then they just shut up all together. And people who came to town, when I first showed up there, I got bit by a dog. I had a shotgun stuck in my face. I had innumerable doors slammed in my face. I had my tires slashed. I mean, there was an outright hostility. They thought I was undercover. They thought I was FBI. But they were very, very angry at the way they were portrayed, and they were, and they had all the reason to be angry, because it was that media that goes for the cheap, shallow story.
Yeah, and I can see this in terms of you know, analyzing people in a place like Skidmore, Missouri, or Hamburg, Iowa, or any of these other types of towns. I can see them looking at the what they would have perceived of as the coverage of the liberal elitist Eastern news media in the United States, and all of these guys in the international news media that don't like small towns, they don't like small town culture, they don't like our religious views, they basically hold us in contempt, and therefore we're not going to cooperate with them.
Right.
In regard to that whole situation, you've already partially answered the question in your last bits of conversation about what you went through when you first arrived in Skidmore. How did you penetrate that? How did you finally get the degree of cooperation that you obviously got for this book? Tell us about how long it took you before you felt that you were perceived differently by the majority of the people in the town. And then if we can get into maybe another subsidiary question, do you think the final truth, the final verdict on this will eventually be told?
One of the things that helped me was I was from a small town in Nebraska, and I told everybody that. I told them that I was not out to solve the killing. I was not there to prove who the killers were, and that I would go through McElroy's experience with the criminal justice system, case by case, acquittal by acquittal, and prove what they knew had happened. I would take it apart. I'd go through the records, I'd interview the judges, and I would show one way or another how the criminal justice system had failed. And the other thing I did was I came back. I came back time and again. I was there for a month. I was there for 2 months. They got used to seeing me around. The Playboy, all the other people came in. They were there for 3 days. They were there for 2 weeks max. They wrote a story, and then they were gone. So that had a lot to do with it. The key factor, though, was I was taken in by a leading farm family, the Gosley family. I just made a connection with a few of the brothers, and then the farmer himself, the patriarch of the family, invited me to stay at the house, and I became basically a part of that family. And that was it was a blessing in the sense that that opened a lot of doors, and pretty soon I was able to go into the coffee shop. Now, I didn't, in those public places, I didn't bring McElroy up. I didn't say who shot McElroy or how do you feel about it. I just kind of became there. And as the years went on, I probably spent two-thirds of every year living in that town with the family. They became used to seeing me. I mean, they are, you know, they're basically down deep, good, decent people, and they like other human beings. And by the time I left, I was selling tickets at the Mother's Day, at the church Sunday morning for the Mother's Day Bazaar. I was judging a dance contest, which was really a bizarre moment. They have an annual festival they call the Pumpkin Show. And you're right, by the way the Eastern press looks at these people, they looked at them not only as hicks, but as murdering hicks, which made it even a better story. But in any event, by the time I left, I was pretty much a part of the community itself. I think a large part of it was because I was as non-threatening as possible, and I lived with this family. It's kind of an old anthropological technique where you go in and you try and get the blessing of a leading family, and that's what happened here.
Yes. And, you know, in terms of your point that this whole situation was pre-cable news, it was pre-O.J. Simpson and so forth, I'm reminded of something that I went through in 1995, the 94-95 time frame when the Simpson thing was going on. I was pastoring a church in a small community between Kerrville and Medina, Texas. And at that juncture, I had taken a virtual oath to myself that I was not going to watch any of the CNN coverage of the Simpson trial. You know, I would look at it, you know, when it was on the front page of the San Antonio Express News or the Dallas paper, I would certainly read a paragraph summary of the thing and then just try to put it aside. But I couldn't do that because I discovered that there were a couple of members of my congregation, shut-ins, nice elderly people, who were absolutely glued to this thing. They were riveted to that television set the entire time that trial was going on. And so when I would make my obligatory visits to them a couple of times a week, there it was. I was confronted by Johnny Cochran and Marcia Clark and all the rest of that stuff. And to me, as I tried to put into perspective what a media blitz like that would be like, not in Southern California, but in the rural Midwest, in a place like Skidmore, Missouri, do you think if that type of a media inferno, post O.J. Simpson, post cable news, and so forth, had been possible in the early 1980s, that it would have eventually brought the truth out in Skidmore, or do you think that their resolve not to cooperate and not to talk would have been even stronger?
I don't think it would have changed. I mean, for 9 months they had 12 FBI agents all over that countryside. They went and they jerked those farmers off their tractors. They handcuffed them to their machinery. They told them someone else, you know, was ratting them out as the killer or a witness. And they did all of their usual techniques, which work on very sophisticated people. And it didn't work then. And they were very, very sophisticated, and they didn't get one person to talk.
You know, when we come back, I want to return to that a little bit to discuss the character of those farmers vis-a-vis federal law enforcement and investigative types. This is Mark Dankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, and the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned for Harry McLean and his book, In Broad Daylight.
This is Steve Shank with Fearless Radio and RBN, your only source for solutions to problems of troubled times. Do you realize that 3 years ago, the JMS Food Group warned people that there would come a time when if you didn't grow it yourself, or you already had it stored, you wouldn't dare eat it? Wait a minute. E. coli on our spinach and lettuce? That's our food you're talking about. You know where E. coli comes from? Feces, black water. In short, poop. We have to decide quickly to get all the food we're going to need. It's obvious that contamination can leave us hungry even before food shortages shut us down. For help ordering your food supply and protection from dishonest suppliers, call 800-409-5633. On the web, efoodsdirect.com. On the phone, 800-409-5633.
Do you know the truth about cancer treatments? Do you realize that with all presently accepted methods, you are not correctly attacking the cancer and you're mostly fighting to survive the treatment? Do you realize that mutilating surgery, burning, and poisoning of your entire system are totally unnecessary? But now it's cancer's turn to die with LaserMed Inc.'s patented methodology. Without cutting, bleeding, drugs, or damaging radiation, we can destroy skin cancer and breast tumors of any size without adverse side effects at our physician's office. Laser technology at its best. For more information, call 702-953-0267 or visit www.lasermedinc.com. That's www.lasermedinc.com. Or call 702-953-0267.
Do you ever wonder how an opera singer that hits a high note is able to shatter a wine glass? Well, the glass has a natural resonant frequency. If the resonant frequency making the glass vibrate is powerful enough, the size of the vibration will become so large the glass shatters. Using this same principle, Royal Raymond Rife discovered that disease-causing organisms can be destroyed using different resonant frequencies. The BioSolutions frequency instrument uses the same technology for relief or elimination of pain and disease conditions with no side effects. The 2006 BioSolutions Plus is the easiest to operate frequency instrument ever developed. Its easy reference guide will allow you to begin using the instrument within minutes. Customer satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. Don't just treat symptoms, eliminate the cause. For more information, call BioSolutions toll-free, 1-866-885-6625. That's 1-866-885-6625. Once again, 1-866-885-6625.
This is Mark Mancos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight, recently reissued in a revised edition by St. Martin's Press. Harry, before the break, I was getting ready to say that, in regard to this whole thing of the news media, the post cable TV, post O.J. Simpson era in which we live, and the way in which, of course, it covers things in a fashion that I cannot imagine what it would mean if all of this was brought to bear on a town the size of Skidmore, Missouri. Clearly enough, as we look at this whole thing, it kind of reminds me of something that I went through a number of years ago as a Lutheran pastor. Situation I can't talk about over the air, or for that matter to anybody, but where somebody came to me for help, involved another state, another time and place, but basically it involved a circumstance of something that definitely required the help and intervention of outsiders. And in this particular case, I convinced this person that they really needed to talk to the FBI. And so I ended up being the go-between between this person and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They didn't know me from Adam. I contacted them, told them who I was. set up an initial meeting between myself and the FBI agent where I explained the situation to the agent. Agent was a very nice fellow, listened very attentively, very sharp guy, very amazing background. He then agreed to meet with this person in my presence initially, and then later I was asked to leave them alone so that they could have conversation on their own turf and their own merits. But the long and the short of it is that the individual that I'm thinking of who did chat with the FBI, and in that particular case, it was a positive meeting ultimately. It resulted in some good things transpiring. Nonetheless, it was a circumstance for them where it was a terrifying thought to be talking to someone from federal law enforcement. But this was a fairly sophisticated, educated person who ultimately did come forth and talk conversationally about the things that needed to be shared with this person for the well-being of a lot of people, I might add. But in the case that you're talking about, of course, it seems that there is yet another perception of federal law enforcement that was going on at the time in Skidmore, Missouri. And again, I'm amazed as we go through this once more that whether you're talking about a grand jury in Kansas City or you're talking about the fact that there was a 9-month FBI investigation that transpired in this situation, and then, of course, the international, for what was in a pre-cable news era, was an international media circus in this small town, that once again we get to the fact of the matter, and that is that all these years later, we're talking about a circumstance where you have penetrated more of this than anyone has. I think that's a fair statement. And do you think that all these years later, someone would eventually share with you in confidence the real truth of what really happened? I know you have said on the record that information would stay with you if anyone chose to share it at a future juncture. Do you think anyone will on that basis?
You know, I think I now, after I get into the files, I now have a complete list of everybody who was on the street that day. And I think if I set out to get an eyewitness account of what happened, and I went through them one by one, and I called, and I made the assurances, I could probably come up with it. The truth of the matter is I don't think it would be any different than what I have written, than what I know. But the impact would be to have somebody sitting there telling me face-to-face, I was here, I turned and saw the shooter take his gun out and so forth. But in terms of the facts as I know them, I think they're pretty accurate. And let me say on the media thing, if there were to be a trial, if one of those witnesses came forward now and the prosecutor had to proceed with prosecuting the two killers, there would be one of those incredible, sensational, moment-by-moment trials all over again. And it would traumatize that small town. I mean, they would, and that's another reason why I don't particularly care whether it's solved or not, is the price that town would pay in terms of the media coverage descending on them and characterizing in that same negative fashion would probably just about do them in. It would be horrible to watch.
Well, yes, and the thing that comes forth consistently in your book, which I have read in its entirety, and it certainly comes forth in talking with you on the telephone off the record as well as talking on the air, and that is that in terms of the moral complexities of this situation, in terms of trying to get to the bottom of that angle of things in the lives of the people in question, in regard to understanding this culture as someone who grew up in a small town in the Midwest, and perceiving from the inside why they feel the way that they feel about big media and about government investigations and grand juries and FBI agents and so forth, it seems to me that your whole book, while it does deal to some extent with the whole issue of what is the most likely scenario in regard to what happened on July 10th, 1981, that your book seems to me to deal with more of the ethical ramifications and the complexities of this from a more holistic perspective than we're likely to ever see in anything reported by corporate media. We will be back with Harry McClain when Mark Dankoff's America returns from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. You can call us at 1-800-313-9443. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. because you can handle the truth.
There is one and only one national populist news weekly, staffed by an unsurpassed team of veteran investigative journalists who have dared to rip the veil of deception from the cover-up stories promoted by the big money-controlled media monopoly.
American Free Press.
AFP's no-holds-barred journalists fearlessly seek the truth, no matter how controversial the issue. AFP publishes exciting, in-depth, uncensored news and information good patriotic Americans need to know to combat the coming police state being clamped in our republic. The American Free Press is your voice. Subscribe today and catch up on the real news. Mention RBN when you call and receive a one-year subscription, plus a copy of Michael Collins Piper's latest bestseller, The High Priests of War. All that for just $49? Call AFP toll-free, 888-699-NEWS, or visit AmericanFreePress.net.
It's true. Gold and silver have been a source of true wealth for years. In fact, people around the world have used these metals to buy and sell goods for over 5,000 years. And gold and silver will continue to be a source of true wealth for the foreseeable future. If you look back in history, you'll see that all fiat currencies have failed to maintain wealth or failed altogether. But gold has always protected its holder, a true asset, usable to anyone around the globe. As the value of your Federal Reserve note continues to depreciate, gold will be your only insurance. As an example, in 1975, you could buy a $40,000 home with 1,000 gold coins. Today, that same house is $400,000, yet you can still buy it with 1,000 gold coins. To find out more information on how to protect your wealth, call Republic Trading at 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.
America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight, originally a New York Times bestseller, now reissued in paperback by St. Martin's Press with 68 pages of new information, including a very interesting epilogue. Harry, I was reading a little bit about your biography last night. Of course, you're a lawyer. You're a writer living in Denver. And in the legal business, you've worked as a juvenile court magistrate, you've been a first assistant attorney general, an associate professor of law, a general counsel of the Peace Corps, you've been a labor arbitrator. So obviously, anyone who knows anything about resume analysis would look at you and say, this is a guy who's smart, he's analytical, he can speak, he can write, he can also interact with people and in a positive sense of the word, a non-manipulatory sense of the word, get them to trust him and to share with him. I think that's how this book came together in terms of those types of skills. But I'm curious as to what initially led you to investigate this story and what led you to stay after you were initially threatened in Skidmore on more than one occasion.
Well, I was practicing law in Denver, and like a lot, if not most lawyers, pretty bored. And like a lot, if not most lawyers, I've always wanted to write a book. And I saw a little clip in Time magazine, and it was entitled, sure enough, Town Kills Bully. And I looked at it, and I thought, that's pretty interesting. Being from a small town and all, I'm sure that they'll crack it sooner or later with all those witnesses. And as time went on, there would be little clips in the paper. Well, the county grand jury disbanded, no indictment. The state grand jury disbanded, no indictment. And then I saw federal grand jury convene in Kansas City. And I ran a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C. once, and they are they're the most intimidating instrument of the legal system. I mean, you have the federal judge in the federal courthouse, you have the U.S. attorney, the FBI, and I thought if they can haul those farmers in front of that grand jury and not crack one of them, then I'm going to write a book on it. Because what really started to fascinate me is what we talked about earlier, and that's the silence. How did it come about? How did it maintain? And what price were the people paying for maintaining the silence? So 9 months later, 10 months later, there's a little clip in the paper. Federal grand jury disbands, no indictment. A week later, I jumped in my Mazda and whipped across the plains in Nebraska to Missouri.
And, again, to me, that is one of the most fascinating aspects of this story. Not knowing as much about Middle Western culture as you do, but knowing enough to where I feel that I can say that I would know something as to the mindset, the work ethos, the commitment to integrity, the religious backgrounds of the typical farm family in the rural Midwest, and what some of those things mean in terms of the way, frankly, that I was raised. Because although I was raised by an Air Force officer, he was a part of that Middle Western culture, that rural Middle Western culture, small town America. Went to a Disciples of Christ church, this sort of thing, and you told the truth, you didn't lie, you were fair with people, you had compassion for people, you trusted authority figures. You think of doctors, ministers, lawyers, school teachers. You cooperated with these people, and then when you start thinking about not only local law enforcement, but state law enforcement and federal law enforcement, the ethos certainly that my parents grew up with is that, hey, these people are to be respected, they're to be trusted. When they ask you a question, you're courteous and you tell them the truth, whatever it is. And it seems to me that since that is undoubtedly the ethos of these folks in Skidmore, Missouri,
absolutely,
I come back once again to the incredible internal agony and angst of a group of people committed to those values who nonetheless find themselves, due to circumstances that are complicated beyond the human imagination, saying, hey, we're not going to talk. We're going to stay silent on this thing. And to me, as I'm picturing some of the folks that I know back in Hamburg, Iowa, and again, the way that they are, the way that they look at reality, their basic integrity and decency, I can't imagine what it would take if they received a visit from an FBI agent. Received a visit from FBI agents who were hauled before a federal grand jury in Kansas City, that they would emerge from those encounters not having told what they knew. That, to me, is the most incredible aspect of this story.
Yeah, basically, they're felons because they're unconvicted, uncharged felons. But they raised their right hand, and they swore an oath to tell the truth, and they didn't. And like you say, they in those Midwestern values of truthfulness, respect, and so forth, went out the window with that. Now, they had a greater value at stake. They would say survival. We were in a fight for survival. We had no choice. And they believed that. But that did not, as you understand, as you're explaining, that did not resolve the underlying moral conflict of having shot somebody and now kind of approving of the shooting outside the law. And they're tormented. I mean, they won't, it's very hard for them to describe it. They're not verbal people. They're, you know, they spend 12 hours a day on their combines, and when they talk about farming and news and so forth. Their own internal world, their feelings, their emotions, their perceptions aren't normally talked about to any great degree. And so this is very hard for them to talk about. Even if they want to, they have trouble kind of getting beyond the platitudes. But you can see it, you can feel it, and it's very traumatic. It's kind of like PTSD for him. It's this big, when the Stinnett case happened, this woman who was murdered and her baby taken out, it kind of re-traumatized them all over again. And I went there, and I could see it on their faces, and they were even more hostile to the press. Nobody talked to the press, and the press would come up to me, and they'd say, "Who are you?" I'd say, "I'm here." "Well, how come they're talking to you? How come you can go into the tavern and into the coffee shop, and they don't throw you out like they throw us out?" but they do continue to pay the price. And as to whether anybody was going to will talk one day, which you mentioned earlier, they're starting to die. Six or seven of the witnesses have died already, and I always wondered if we wouldn't get a deathbed confession out of one of them. Somebody would confess to his on his deathbed to his pastor or to his family, just to get it off their chest, so they could go into eternity with a clean slate. And it's not happening.
Fascinating. What's the situation with McElroy's wife and kids today? What's your take on all of that?
Trina was originally a victim of his. Ken McElroy was sleeping with her mother when she was 12. He then switched from the mother to Trina when she was 13, and was initially charged with 22 counts of raping and child molesting and kidnapping, all of which were dropped when this Kansas City lawyer set it up so he could marry her. By that time, she was, I think, 15. And although she was a victim, by the time he was shot, about 5 or 6 years before he was shot, she was riding with him. She was riding shotgun. She was very much a part of his reign of terror. She was pulling shotguns on law enforcement officers and covering up for him and so forth. So she was she identified the killer from the very beginning. And she watched it all happen. She's sitting in the truck, and she sees Del Clement, one of the ranchers, go by. She turns around and looks at him and watches him pull a rifle out of his truck and says, "Ken, they're going to shoot you." And Ken sits there and lights a cigarette. It's kind of like, I don't think they had the guts. And sure enough, they start opening up. But she gave an eyewitness statement, and I read it and I interviewed her, and it's a very sound, credible statement. I interviewed her down. So she was kind of in this dilemma. Without Ken there, who was she? She had three kids of his she had to maintain. She moved down to the Ozarks and remarried what seemed to be a very good man, and was trying to move away from it. But she sounded like a girl. She sounded kind of a high, soft voice. So this time she was 26 or 27, and it felt like I was interviewing a child, a 13-year-old girl. I think she kind of fixated right when McElroy got a hold of her and never evolved beyond that point. I've heard that since then. I did not interview her for the re-release because I kind of wanted to leave her alone. I do know that she's gotten divorced from that husband and is remarried. Some of her kids have gotten in trouble. Some of McElroy's other kids have gotten in trouble. But I really hope that she has been able to put her life together in a decent fashion.
Yes, and you know, as we talk about this, you know, and I think of your description of McElroy's relationship with her mother, and then subsequently with her, and the type of a man he was in terms of a long string of criminal actions and involvements for years leading up to his own killing. Did you ever come across any evidence that McElroy was indirectly or directly involved in the occult in any way?
No, he wasn't. There wasn't much of that going on there. There wasn't any either occult or cult. There was a small town across the river, Falls City, Nebraska, that had a very nasty cult in it that ended up to be a fairly well-known case. But there was neither the occult or the cult aspect in McElroy. He was a very paranoid individual. He thought the rest of the farmers there, the wealthy farmers, saw him and his family as white trash. And he kind of lived his whole, that was kind of his mainspring. He kind of went out, he lived his life in order to prove them wrong, to prove that he was better, stronger, tougher, meaner, and wealthier. So he got their daughters. He took great delight in sleeping with their wives. And he was kind of like always, his whole thing was payback. His whole life was based on the notion of getting even with the people of Skidmore. It started off in a much broader area than Skidmore. It's about 7 or 8 counties in northwest Missouri. But by the time it came to an end, he had started focusing on this town. And his paranoia, you know, got greater and greater. And finally the town stood up to him. But it was very much him and him alone against the town.
Yes, and you know, in chapter 3 of your book, there's a conversation about Ken McElroy and his early upbringing and the context of his life. And it seems to me that one of the themes that emerges in this book very strongly is that both he and his brother never really found their niche in terms of the work ethic of the small town of the Midwest. And I'm reading something here in chapter 3 of your book where you had some feedback from his brother, McElroy's brother, to the effect that Ken never really got over the fact that he was poor. He resented people who had money and new clothes, new cars and good clothes. He could never bring himself to do their menial work. But if you didn't go to school and you wouldn't work, there was really only one other way to get by. So it seems to me that in terms of the analysis that you provide toward the end of chapter 3, this pretty much sets the stage then for his career in criminal activities thereafter.
Yeah, and he could, if he hadn't had this natural cunning to him and this natural ability to sense people's weaknesses, he would have just been another criminal who would have gotten locked up when he was 22 and been in and out of jail until somebody killed him. But he stands out because there's a lot of those people in that area that kind of alienated like that. They don't do well in school and so forth. But this sense, this innate intelligence that he had, completely untrained, uneducated, was what allowed him to kind of rise above the man. And one of the things that used to really get to the farmers in Skidmore was when McElroy would be described as a hog farmer. They would say, he wouldn't know a hog from a cow. He never worked a day in his life. That used to drive him nuts when they would see him described as a hog farmer on the outside of Missouri. You know, he did work. In the middle of the night, he got out and took his truck and went and unloaded antiques and chemicals and animals from people's farms, but it's not what most of us would think as legitimate work, certainly.
Yes. Well, where do you see, by the way, I know you have a website. I wanted to make sure that listeners had an opportunity to get to that in the middle of our conversation here in these last 15 minutes or so. Could you give that to us again?
It's inbroaddaylightbook.com, and thank you for letting me mention it.
Yes, and that's inbroaddaylightbook.com?
Correct.
Good. And I'll make sure that in terms of my broadcast interview source news release on the show, that comes out of Washington, D.C., that URL gets included in the news release. Where do you see yourself going from here in terms of your career as an investigative journalist? Do you think, given the fact that you've had such an incredible success with this book over a 25-year period of time and that people are clamoring for it again, do you think that will lead you ultimately into another project of this type?
Well, I did write a second book. It was called Once Upon a Time, A True Story of Memory Murder and the Law. And that was the story. It's also, by the way, it wasn't the New York Times that published In Broad Daylight. I made a misstatement there. It was HarperCollins.
It was HarperCollins. Okay,
HarperCollins,
so
yeah.
HarperCollins did the original publication and now St. Martin's Press,
right,
the follow-up.
Right.
Okay.
And HarperCollins published the second book. It was the story. It was a fascinating story about a woman, 28 years old, who claimed to recover a repressed memory of her daughter being murdered 20 years earlier by her father, by her best friend being murdered. I'm sorry. Let me say that again. She claimed to recover a repressed memory of her best friend being murdered 20 years earlier by her father. And her best friend had been murdered, and they had never solved it. She's 28. She looks at her own daughter and gets this repressed memory, supposedly. And they prosecute the father and convict him of murder based on nothing but this repressed memory. So that was the second book that I did. And then 2 years ago, I threw a dart at a map. It landed in Dover, Delaware, shut down my house, closed my bank accounts, took a bus, a suitcase, $500 and lived in a small town for a year just to see what it would be like if I wasn't a lawyer or a writer. I ended up being a correctional officer of all things, being a prison guard in a maximum security prison. That book is being written now. So that's kind of where I am.
Yes. Well, I tell you, when that next book comes out, I can't imagine where that's going to take the public. I wanted to mention to our listeners on the air that the in terms of In Broad Daylight, this book has been favorably reviewed by the Kansas City Star, the New York Times Book Review, the Plain Dealer of Cleveland, Publishers Weekly, Kirkus Reviews, the Washington Post Book World, the Houston Chronicle, and now the Rocky Mountain News Sunday Magazine. I was reading an article from December the 15th in that publication about this book. And when we come back, we will be joined again by Harry McLean and his book, In Broad Daylight. This is Mark Dankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned.
Hey, America, how does it feel to be flushed down the toilet of political intrigue and treachery into the sewer of slavery and bondage, where perverts and the godless write the rules? Our unborn children are murdered, our esteemed elders are euthanized, and everyone in between is numbered and tracked like criminals so they can be farmed by government, credit, healthcare organizations, like the chicken farmer farms his chickens. Have you had enough? Is it time to declare your liberty? It's your choice, you know. The only place to begin to declare your independence is to have enough food stored so that you never have to go stand in a bread line to give away the rest of your life or sell your children for a bowl of rice and a slice of bread. Call 800-409-5633. On the web, efoodsdirect.com. 800-409-5633.
Do you suffer from frequent and severe headaches? Well, you don't have to any longer. Headache Stay Gone is an all-natural headache remedy that is free of all side effects. Headache Stay Gone will cure any headache and prevent it from returning again. Painkillers can offer temporary relief at best, along with a long list of harmful side effects. Headache Stay Gone uses all-natural ingredients and cures your headache, letting you enjoy more time with your family and loved ones. We'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone today and send you the bill. Wait until your headache is cured before you pay for it. That's right, Headache Stay Gone must work for you before you pay for it. Try Headache Stay Gone risk-free by calling 1-800-327-0727 or visit www.headachestaygone.com. Again, that's 1-800-327-0727. And don't forget to ask about your risk-free trial today. Call now. Start living life without the headaches.
Sit back, relax, and enjoy a vacation to the beautiful Ozark Mountains. Howard Creek Resort is nestled conveniently between the cities of Bull Shoals and Mountain Home on Bull Shoals Lake in the natural state of Arkansas. Howard Creek Resort offers easy access to excellent fishing and water recreation of all types. The excitement of nearby Branson music shows and Silver Dollar City is accented perfectly by the many attractions located here in the heart of the Ozarks. Horseback riding, water skiing, scuba diving, hiking, caves, and rock climbing are just a few of the many activities that are available to do in our area. Howard Creek Resorts offers it all. Whether you're staying for the weekend or for a month, Howard Creek Resorts is the place to be, an excellent place to stay, and a valued traditional family vacation resort. Visit our website at www.howardcreek.com or call 1-877-253-7690. Come visit us for a lifetime of memories.
America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We have about 6 minutes to go in my segment of the show. And we've been greatly blessed, I think, to have Harry McLean on today, the author of In Broad Daylight, Harry, I'll tell you, listening to a couple of accounts of your literary projects in terms of just wanting to go out and to follow your instinct to do something different and interesting that's avant-garde and that's going to have a positive impact in the lives of many other people, I'm reminded of something I've wanted to do for a long time, haven't done it yet. I'd like to go back to Iran, where I lived many years ago, and write the final chapters of something I started many, many years ago on the subject of having lived in that country. I'd like to go back to a lot of places that I knew years ago. I'd like to try and find people that I knew then to see if they're still around, the local community. I'd like to travel to all kinds of new places in that country that I haven't seen yet. And I'd like to write some observances about all of the things that have happened there from a Western perspective since 1978 and 9.
I'm sure it would be fascinating.
Well, that's my own personal goal and project. Don't know if I'll ever do it or not. Give me some tips for the listeners who've always had something that they've wanted to do and haven't done yet. What took you over the top on those?
Well, you know, I think it was kind of a feeling that I was getting older and kind of like missing life, that I was comfortable, that I had it kind of worked out. I had my friends, I had my income, I had my car, you know, I had a regular kind of rhythm to my life, but kind of an underlying sense that I was missing dimensions to it, that I was missing things in people, that I was missing things in nature. And so it's kind of an effort to get out and see things with a fresh eye. It sounds kind of like a cliche, but it's kind of like step out of your comfort zone, to use another cliche, and see what you can see and try and articulate it from where you are now in life, as opposed to so going back and visiting where you lived earlier and looking at it now from this perception, from this point in your life, I think would be absolutely fascinating, because part of your discussion, part of your narrative would be how it seems different to you now than when you once lived there. So kind of finding the newness in life. And you know, one of the things I think is you don't have to throw your life kind of into complete chaos to do it, which is what I did. If you always wanted to be a violin player, or you always wanted to be a poet, or you wanted to be a long-haul truck driver, there are ways to do those things and kind of keep life intact. It doesn't mean bailing out on your life. It means getting a little clarity on what those things are. And there is a moment of courage where you have to make a decision, because you will have to give some things up, but it's very, very rewarding to me.
Yes, and I think as I was reading your book, I would just like to say to the listeners, and this is my sincere opinion, I'm always noted as somebody who, if I say something on the air, people reliably know that it's what I actually think. This book that you've written in broad daylight, to me, is a valuable book because it covers the dimensions of this in a way that involves ethical complexity, compassion and decency, and a first-rate commitment to research. I recommend this book to everybody out there who's listening. And we have been with Harry McLean today, the author of In Broad Daylight, St. Martin's Press. This is Mark Gankoff's America, closing shop today from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Thank you to Harry McLean, and God bless all of you. See you tomorrow.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
Criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
Americans who own guns, people like you and me, prevent over 1 million violent crimes every year. Get the facts on gun control. visit armedandsecure.org. That's armedandsecure.org.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.